Welcome to Conversations with Big Rich. This is an interview-style podcast. These interviewed are all involved in the off-road industry. Being involved, like all of my guests are, is a lifestyle, not just a job. I talk to past, present, and future legends, as well as business owners, employees, media, and land use warriors, men and women who have found their way into this exciting and addictive lifestyle we call off-road. We discuss their personal history, struggles, successes, and reboots. We dive into what drives them to stay active in off-road. We all hope to shed some light on how to find a path into this world that we live and love and call off-road.
Whether you're crawling the Red Rocks of Moab or hauling your toys to the trail, Maxxis has the tires you can trust for performance and durability. Four wheels or two, Maxxis tires are the choice of champions because they know that whether for work or play, for fun or competition, Maxxis tires deliver. Choose Maxxis. Tread victoriously.
Have you seen 4Low magazine yet? 4Low magazine is a high-quality, well-written, four-wheel drive-focused magazine for the enthusiast market. If you still love the idea of a printed magazine, something to save and read at any time, 4Low is the magazine for you. 4Low cannot be found in stores, but you can have it delivered to your home or place of business. Visit 4LowMagazine.com to order your subscription today. On today's episode of Conversations with Big Rich, we have Adam Skinny Lunn. I don't know if he's still going by Skinny anywhere, but maybe some of the old rock crawlers. But Adam has been around for quite a while in the rock crawling scene. As a young kid, he got started. We'll get into the age and all that. But he progressed himself up to a full-time fabricator, shop, and desert racer. So, Adam, thank you for coming on board and spending some time with us.
Yeah, awesome. Thanks for having me, Rich. It's been a while, and I look forward to catching up.
Yeah, so let's just jump right in with both feet and find out where you were born and raised.
I was born and raised in Wichita Falls, Texas. It's about 2 hours north of Dallas-Fort Worth, and kind of right here on the Red River. And born and raised here, and actually, out of all the crazy and wild places I've worked and lived, I've kind of come full circle, and that's where I'm living back today, a suburb of right near where I grew up, and that's where my shop is.
Oh, excellent. And when you grew up in Wichita Falls, I've been through there a number of times, were you like in town or were you on the outskirts, more rural?
I was in town, but my family's always been into ranching and a little in the oil business. So we were always running around ranch and lease roads, and that's kind of how I got into four-wheeling, to be honest with you.
Okay. And those early school years, were they, how did they impact your future life? Were you studious or were you a little rebellious or whatever?
I was always pretty good at school, but once I got to high school, and I'm sure like a lot of guys back then, it was, you know, pre all the phones like it is now, everybody was into the magazines. So probably about 15 or 16, once I got my first truck, I was in school with magazines tucked in the books, acting like I was doing schoolwork, but I was almost always over there sketching up off-road cars and trucks and making lists of modifications and reading magazines and seeing what everybody was doing in the off-road scene.
And did your school, high school, offer like industrial shop classes or anything like that?
Yeah, they did. And actually, like, I give big credit to them for being one of the few that still had it back in that day. They're kind of coming back around now, but we had what they just called ag, and that was at a full metal fab shop with torch and welders, and you could go in there and kind of use the stuff as your own and really dive into it. And that was key. I kind of did that my junior and senior year, and that's when I kind of got bit by the, I enjoyed driving them, but even to this day, I'm not sure which I like more, driving or building them. I kind of got bit by the fab bug there and haven't been able to kick it since.
Very nice. So then when you were at that age where you said your family had, you know, did some ranching and that kind of stuff, and you were out on the ranch roads, were you driving yourself or were you What was the first vehicle you got to drive?
So first vehicle I drove was a 60s F-100 two-wheel drive, which sliding around, you know, down here in the South, you drive pretty young. I mean, we were probably 10, maybe a 9, 8 starting driving that thing. And then in high school, I wanted a back then it was like the thing. I wanted a Z71 pickup so bad, and got a used extended cab four-wheel drive Z71 pickup when I was 16, and then you know, lifted it up, put it on mud tires, and was into, you know, back then it was just mud bogging, hill climbing, just kind of, you know, rallying that thing around. And that's what led me to start grabbing the magazines, and that's kind of when I started seeing, you know, got bored with the mud and then seeing all these guys on rocks, and was like, man, just fascinated with it. So as ridiculous as it sounds, I like started chopping this thing up and thought I was going to rock crawl a Z71 pickup, and was just, you know, really fascinated with it. And then realized real quick, a Z71 is a little too big for rock crawling. So then it kind of migrated into K5 Blazers and Jeeps. And, my dad, he was hacked at me because he thought I was tearing up this nice truck. So he made me a deal. He said, why don't we sell the truck and get a little commuter car, and then I'll let you have $5,000 to buy a beater. You can do whatever you want to that thing. So got a K5 Blazer and made kind of a buggy out of it. And that was really the start to, you know, what I consider real off-roading.
And when was the first time and where did you get a chance to get out on the rocks?
So we kind of like, we just, you know, mess around here local. There's some actual somewhat mild rock crawling around that we would do. And then I saw in the magazines that everyone was going up to these places in Oklahoma, Clayton, Oklahoma, Disney, Oklahoma, which are still popular to this day. And they had, back then it was one of the first K5 runs. There was a form called Colorado K5, and they had a big run out there in Disney. And I begged my granddad. I said, I got to get to this thing. Can I borrow a pickup and a trailer? And I towed my Blazer up there and saw for the first time what real rock crawling was, and met guys from around the country and how cool that was, all the camaraderie and, you know, in the industry and the sport, everybody helping each other fix their rigs, and was just kind of bitten from there. And then saw that they were going to have a rock crawling championship event in Johnson Valley, California. They were going to pay, I think it was maybe $20,000 back in the day. And that's all I could do, is just read about this competition every month in the magazine and convince my granddad as my senior year to haul all the way out there with me from Wichita Falls, 28 hours, something like that. And hauled that thing to Johnson Valley. And that was my first competition. I think I had just turned 17. So probably 98, 99, somewhere right in there.
Okay. And, did you actually compete at that one?
Yeah, I did. And honestly, like, we were what I would consider decent for back home. I thought we were pretty good. I'll make you laugh, Rich. I figured we would go out there and probably win the thing, some cocky kid. And so I show up. And the first thing I see is Jason Pauley's buggy in the parking lot where we were staying the night I got there. And I'd never laid eyes on something like with a whole tube chassis, rear steer, a real buggy. And I was just in shock. And I remember looking at my granddad, and he even knew nothing about the sport. And we could see all the other rigs in the parking lot. And I think right away we both knew we were a little bit outgunned. But still, I thought we could probably get it done. And long story short, my grandpa said we showed up with four-wheel drive and we left with one-wheel drive. We broke about everything on that car. We at least started every obstacle both days, and I think we got dead last, but it was the most fun I'd ever had, and I was hooked on it. And my granddad, he has a little bit of rodeo background, and the whole time he kind of spent researching and watching the guys that were doing good. And we went and watched the awards, and he told me, he said, and Jason Pauley won that event. And he said, what we need to do is we got to go talk to that guy. The rig we're in isn't going to cut it. If we even see if you've got any talent at all, we're going to have a better car. And so, we approached Jason in the parking lot and George Waits and after about buying their car. And, they told me they had just built it and that one wasn't for sale, but they had just, they had previously been crawling in a CJ7 that was pretty heavily modified and thought it'd be a good one for me to get going and learn in. So we kind of struck a deal right there with George and Jason to get that old CJ. And that's, my granddad, I think a little bit, he got the bug as well at that point and kind of saw the fire in my eyes. So we were, he told me, he said, I can't fund your way in this thing all the way, but I'll get you started and, get you a car to learn in, and maybe you can get some sponsors and a little help and work hard and get a job and, put in your own money and maybe do this if that's what you want to do. And that's kind of how it all started, as far as that. And then I realized, you know, living back then, almost everything was kind of like off-road racing. The capital of it all was more in the Southwest. So I convinced my parents that I wanted to go to Arizona State to go to college, mainly in the back of my mind, knowing that's just where all the good wheeling was, and to be more centrally located to the competitions. But kind of convinced mom and dad that I was just mainly interested in the academics out there. But as soon as I got out there, I immediately just started crawling pretty much every day out there. And that's, you know, when I would really say it all started kind of coming to fruition.
And who did you hook up with first in Arizona?
So back then, Pirate 4x4, it was just really starting to get big. And so I remember I had nowhere, of course, to keep a buggy or my Jeep in my trailer. And so I just put a post up, seeing if anybody would help me. And Ian Willis-Jablad, one of the first guys I met, he didn't even know me. He reached out, still friends to this day, one of the nicest guys. He quickly volunteered that I could keep my trailer and Jeep at his mom's house and work on it in there if I needed, or at his shop. And, you know, I'd seen him doing well in the comps. He was in the scene as well. And so, you know, I really appreciated his offer. And he was running around with Randy Ellis and Shannon Campbell and Rob Bonnie and those guys. And all of them at that point to me were just like, you know, legends, just like Jason Pauly and these guys, like, you know, starstruck, you know, almost, I'd say, back then. And I remember Shannon had a shop there, and so I called him and just wanted to come by and check it out. And, you know, they said, sure, come on by. And I went in there and you know, saw they were building the IFS crawler at the time, the Cadillac, on the table. And I mean, I was just, my head was exploded at what these guys were doing and building, and they had so many cool tools and, you know, just ate up everything they were doing. So I asked Shannon for a job, and he laughed at me and said, dude, everyone that works in here's last name's Campbell. Sorry for you. It's not going to work out. And so I was kind of disturbed. So I thought about it, and I talked to my granddad that night and was like, man, he told me no. And my granddad said, well, I'd get back out there with the broom tomorrow and just get to work. And I said, well, he told me he didn't hire me. And he said, well, I didn't say you're going to get paid. I said, I'd get out there and get to work. So the next day I went out there like my granddad said to do. And I just said hi in there, kind of wondering what I was doing. And it was kind of awkward. I just grabbed a broom and started sweeping. And Shannon's like, what are you doing, kid? I just, you know, I told you no, and we don't need anybody. And I said, I'll work for free. And he said, what? I said, I'll work for free. And he said, you're going to drive over here every day and just clean up, and you don't want anything. And I was like, nothing. Just let me watch what you guys are doing. He said, well, stay out of the way and don't get hurt. He kind of, I think, tried to run me off that first week. He had me weed eating his house. I mean, all kinds of, washing trucks and trailers. And you know, I'd hang out in there in the evenings. All their buddies would come over after work and help them work on stuff at night, and I'd hang over. And he later told me that I made him laugh, so they kind of kept me around. And I think maybe a month later, he kind of felt guilty. And I was working my butt off, or at least thought I was. And he said, hey, man, why don't I pay you $5 an hour? And I mean, I was at that point on top of the world. I was working in my mind. I didn't care how much money it was for. It was for Shannon Campbell. And then we started wheeling together, and he saw, I think, I had a little bit of talent, and offered to help me get into one of his cars at the shop if I worked on it in the night and the evenings up there with him. And so him and Nick helped me get my first car together that was what I consider a real buggy all tube chassis. And we debuted at Farmington Supercrawl. Was doing all right. I think we finished top 10, but kind of had an untimely rollover. And then I think two or three events later, we had our first podium, and Shannon kind of helped me at the time. He was really good with sponsors, and he kind of helped me get in the door with some product sponsors, which was huge on my car. He always, you know, everyone says it, but he really did. I mean, take me in under his wing. I mean, they were feeding me at the house. I was living in Waylon's room there for a little while. He was a little baby. I was riding every morning in the shop back and forth to Shannon, and about school only lasted about 4 or 5 months. And I decided enough of this school. I was going to be a professional rock crawler. So, quit school without my parents even knowing at the time. And just kept working with Shannon, and then got in with Randy. I ended up doing some work for Randy and Shannon and Ian, all those guys in the time that I lived there. And anybody that knows the Phoenix area knows how big of a hotbed for crawling it was. So, I mean, back then really didn't need a lot of money. I pretty much ate at Shannon's house, and we wheeled every weekend from Friday when we got off to late Sunday and work hard all week, and then either go to her comp or practice wheeling every weekend. I mean, I tell people, I mean, yeah, I was competitive back then, but I was probably doing 20 events a year at the height of it for me. And even the other 30 weekends a year, we'd still go crawling all those. I mean, that's all we did back then was wheel and compete. I mean, that was just, it wasn't a sport. It was a lifestyle back then. And that's what's, you know, people all the time, new guys in the crawling scene will ask me what it was like back then in the quote unquote golden age or whatever. And I'm like, man, it was, you know, I wouldn't even realize how good we had it. Cause I think, yeah, we all wanted to win and win money, but I mean, most everybody was, I mean, we were just cutting up, having a good time with our friends, you know. It was half the fun was in the budget in parking lot after the competition, you know.
So true. So let's go back a little bit. When you went to that first comp and your granddad went with you, did he spot for you?
No, he did not. A friend came with me, and my granddad, a kind of a funny story. He's probably, heck, Rich, he had to be close to 70, maybe even 75 at the time. And big man, my granddad is probably 6'4", 5" and 220, 240, big guy. And so for him, puffing around at that age, you know, I mean, we went in so unprepared, had no water, no coolers. We had no idea what we were getting into, you know, what right. Johnson Valley is. We thought it was going to be like a rodeo arena with concession stands and stuff. And that first one, especially, I mean, we had to bum water, and he tells the story great. He called my grandma, he says, from the shade of a rock. He said he was about to pass out resting, and he said, "This is the worst day I've ever had." Her name's Valene. He said, "This is terrible out here." And she said, "Oh, Ray, that's his name. Just tough it out. I'm sure Adam's having fun." And I didn't know he had said that. Well, then he meets up with me at the end of the first day, and I tell him, "Granddad, this is the best day I've ever had." So he says he gets back to the hotel and calls my granddad, my grandma, and says, "Scratch that. It was a good day. I've never seen a kid so excited." So
that's awesome.
And he came back, and he tried to explain it to his friends in Wichita Falls. And he's like, "You won't believe what these people do. They go out here with these perfectly good cars in the middle of Death Valley, California, and crawl over Volkswagen sized boulders and tear up good equipment for no reason, just to go through some cones."
And that's what we still do.
That's what we still do. But then I remember when I was working for Shannon, his dad had done a lot of off-road racing.
Yes.
And they would always tell me stories about desert racing. And we kind of went to the park or a few of the races around there just to spectate. And being a fabricator and a gearhead, I would look at those desert cars, and Shannon and Don, his dad, would show me. And you know, that was the highest level of fabrication and building and teams and support and just the logistical challenge. And in essence, like, they just, I hadn't experienced it coming from Texas, but they made desert racing like it was, you know, this mythological thing. It seemed so cool to me at the time that, you know, that these trucks had helicopters and hitting jumps at 130 guys on the crew, and seeing chase trucks and TIG welding, and you know, coming even from seeing rock crawling competitions, when you see that, especially back then for the first time, it was kind of awe-inspiring. And so that was the other thing I picked up from even out there in Phoenix, not only really lit the fire for rock crawling, but kind of was my first exposure to desert racing.
Right. And when you were there in Arizona, you ran with Bonnie and Ellis and that group, did you ever work at Four Wheelers as well? Four Wheeler Supply, like the rest of them did?
No, that's actually, I was very good friends with the owner and Rob. That's probably the one place I worked a long time for Randy, long time for Ian, and a long time for Shannon. And then even Desert Wrap, the retail store, I worked there a little bit. I worked about most everywhere in town but Four Wheelers. But Rob was always running. I mean, every weekend it was kind of Rob, Randy, Shannon, Ian, and those guys back then. They'd all meet up, and then we'd have every Wednesday or something, whatever it was, we'd all do lunch, kind of all the Fab Crawl guys, we'd eat lunch together. I mean, those guys were really tight back then. So, you weren't going to run around with one without running with all of them type of deal.
Right. And then how long were you there? I know that you said you went for college. How did your parents feel when they finally found out that you backed
out? They were not thrilled, and I'll probably get it back again as life comes full circle. But they asked they had sent me money for books, which I promptly spent all that money immediately on rock crawling parts and told them I was school was going good, but eventually I knew the report card was going to come. And I'll never forget my dad called me, and usually it's my mom. My dad calls, of course, it's serious. And he had told me the report card had come, and as he said, the ride was over, that if I wasn't in school, if I thought I was grown man enough to not need school, then I was going to have to be 100% a grown man. And I was quote unquote on my own, and the best of luck to me. And of course, like any hard headed kid, I was in my mind working for the best in the industry, doing what I wanted to do. Sure didn't need school. And like any kid, you dang sure don't need your parents' advice. So, almost kind of took it as a challenge. And what you also don't realize is how much your parents really help you. Well, all of a sudden when the car payment on my pickup quit getting paid that they'd been helping with, and the apartment quit getting paid they'd been helping with, all of a sudden $5-$10 an hour isn't cutting it for grown man. And so really had to tighten down at that point. And honestly, that's kind of when I went into what I call gypsy mode, where I, in essence, kind of lived out of a Dodge pickup with my trailer and my buggy and tools, kind of whoever shop I was working with. And really, we'd go to a comp, and if it was in Utah and there was another one there in 2 weeks, we decided, it'd be cheaper just to hang out there rather than go back home and burn all the diesel. So just kind of talk to somebody who lives close at the event and go hang out with them for a week or two in between. And that's really when I got running with Pat Gallagher and Johnny LaMonta, the RP Films guys. They realized I didn't quote unquote have a real job, and crawling kind of was it. So then they kind of pitched the opportunity of I could come stay up there with them. We could do a bunch of filming, kind of offered me a place to live. And in between the comps, we just pretty well would be solid filming footage up there, hanging out. And that's kind of when I got in with Nate, who was my longtime spotter, Jason Pauly's cousin. He was always at the events with Jason, and he had agreed to be my spotter, and he kind of liked that lifestyle too. So Nate and I kind of headed up to Truckee, California, and we were kind of back and forth up in and out of there about a year, and then decided to didn't call Phoenix home anymore at that point, kind of started calling South Dakota home, because when we weren't in California, and that's where Nate's family was from, and Jason had the shop there and had a little work for Nate and I to do and a place for us to work on the buggy. So ended up living between kind of California and South Dakota for the next 2 or 3 years after that.
Okay. One of the times that I remember really well, and I bring it up a lot, was Cougar Buttes at one of the, I'm sure it was Cal Rocks or We Rock at the time, and I'm not sure which one it was, but that you were on course, your car caught on fire.
Yep.
I came running up, trying to get your fire extinguishers off, but you kept moving. And I said, stop, you're on fire. And you go, no, I got to finish the course. I was able to get the fire extinguisher off. We got it. Somebody else came running up and got the other side one. And we got the fire out while you were still driving on course. You never really did stop. And then I think you did finish the course.
Yeah, we did. Yeah, we had a good portion of the car on fire, but you know how it is when you get the, I call it race drunk, when you get the blinders on. And until that fire got to me, if I wasn't burning, I don't think I was stopping until we got done. I mean, I tell people it's a different level of pressure back then, Nate. Now we were trying to win some prize money to get home and eat. So can't be stopping for any fires.
No. I remember after that as well, there was a couple of guys in the crowd that got really mad at me because I used your fire extinguisher. And I was like, dude, that's why they're on the car. That's the closest ones to the fire. What are you getting mad about? And they were drunk, you know, drunk people can be.
Hecklers.
Yeah. And so they just kept on me, and I was getting really ready to throw them out or do something. I'm not sure what. And then Nick Campbell and Nick Hall walked up and said, is there a problem over here? You know, and those guys just, I mean, 4-on-1 was okay. Crawled. All of a sudden, 3-on-4 was the odds were against them.
Yeah. And I can tell you, Nick Campbell's got some heavy hands. You don't want to be messing with that guy.
Yeah. And Nick Call was not a small dude either. He was a snapper.
No.
Oh God, it was those were days. They sure were.
Those were the days. And another good funny one from one of your events. I'll never forget. We were on top an obstacle, and it just got all kinds of crossed up in there. Really had no real option. And I remember Nate looking at me and saying, "I think the only option is just purposely roll the car, and I think we'll go through the finish gate if we roll how I think you're going to roll." And so we just rolled that thing down there, and we were so pumped. I think we got like maybe fifth place, which is like $750. And then, you know, kids don't even realize we probably did 10 grand in damage to win the 750. But in our mind, it was like it worked perfect, you know.
That's awesome. Do you remember what event site that was?
I mean, they all kind of run together, but I'm almost positive. Again, that one was Cedar City.
Okay.
And then another, I remember they had the wall, as everybody calls it. I remember when that was first there at Cedar City, and we drew it for first obstacle day two. So, you know, you had to sleep on it all night. And I remember the last car to go on day one was John Nelson and Tiny. And I remember he rolled all the way. It's one of the most vicious rolls. I don't know if you remember that, Fred, I've ever seen crawling, like all the way from the pirouetted off the top of the wall and probably, you know, 30, 40, 50 foot right to the roll cage, you know, about smash the thing. And so we had to marinate on that all night. And I remember in the morning trying to brush my teeth and like gagging on water. I was so nervous. It was probably the most nervous I've ever been in a crawler was that wall there in Cedar City. And I remember walking it thinking, you know, you promoters have lost your mind. There's no way anybody's going up this. And sure enough, you know how it is. It's you put some bonus cone somewhere, somebody's going to figure out a way, especially back then, to do it. And it was just wild. I remember kind of the walls what started, but just from there, the progression of not only the obstacles of the cars. And it's, you know, I tell people all the time, you can watch video, do whatever you want, but unless you really experience true big crawl, and you know, you can't put it in words. It's phenomenal what's really possible to in those things, you know?
Yeah, that's so true. We have so many people that show up to events now because with all the media, you know, and social media out there and everybody playing the videos and everything, that we get a lot of people that have never seen it in person. They've seen it in video on social media. They show up and they're just absolutely astounded about the difference. You know, oh, that climb and that drop didn't look all that bad. And then they're standing there and they're like, you know, totally blown away.
Yeah.
And yeah. It's not gotten any easier. That's for sure.
perspective is wild. It really is. You know, whenever you walk around and see it with your own eyes, it's mind blowing when you're really in there. It's kind of like big mountain skiing, you know, and if you watch a video, it almost looks easy, but then you stand on top of something and you're like, wow, this is a whole different ball game when you're actually above it, you know?
True. Very true. So then you're up in South Dakota working off and on with Jason Pauley and doing events and stuff like that. What came after that?
Well, after that, I remember rock crawling was kind of, you know, it's debatable what caused it, but you know, some people say the moon buggy, some say whatever the economy at the time, but it, for whatever reason, like everyone was starting to kind of go away from like the competition crawling. Especially like with the two seat cars, what was kind of what I keyed on earlier, what was always so fun to me about the sport is I was able to compete in something that you could also recreationally have fun in.
Right.
And in my mind, like in my personal opinion, no one will ever know. I think what killed the sport, or didn't kill the sport, but hurt the sport, is when the cars went away from something that you could use other than competition. We all went to such small fuel cells, single seaters, you know, moon buggies or variants of it. And those cars, in essence, other than competition, they really don't have any practical use. I mean, sure you can, but how much fun is wheeling a car that can only run for 25 minutes and you can drive by yourself? It's not the same as it was. And so I think when you took the recreational aspect away from it, it kind of lost the fun and allure to a lot of people. So for whatever reason, it seemed like honestly overnight, everybody started going different directions. Guys were getting into short course racing. XRA was kind of popping up. Everybody was starting to, you know, have these murmurs of what rock racing, which to us back then, I'm sure you remember, like there was no such thing prior to that. Like no one ever tried to go fast while you did obstacles. It was all about control, doing it fluid, just traditional crawling.
Right.
And, you know, I was kind of, you know, back in high school, some of my favorite things to do was just high speed gravel road ripping. And then whenever we'd go wheeling on the weekends, half the fun was we'd go race our buggies. I mean, we were basically off-road racing, Shannon, Randy, everybody racing trail to trail, almost what Hammers is now, but just for fun, but in junkie crawlers, you know, just to beat your buddy while you drink beer to the next trail to talk mess. You got there quicker, you know? Right. And so I got rumor that, you know, Shannon, I think he went and did one, and I talked to him, and he was like, man, they're a lot of fun. And one was coming up in Cortez, Colorado. So I kind of outfitted my competition buggy. Some, you know, the old back then, I joke, the race car conversion, all that was back then was like a set of air bump stops. You know, that's all pretty much anybody did on their crawler. Put a bigger gas tank and a set of air bumps, and now you got a off-road racer. And kind of went out there, and we did well. We got a podium, and it was fun, and I, like, really like the adrenaline of going fast. It was kind of a new challenge, and realized that the car was pretty limited. I was going to need to build something from scratch. And then I got to thinking about it. And at that point I'd been watching those desert people videos like over and over, you know, and it was just obsessed with kind of what I keyed on earlier, desert racing. And was like, maybe this is a good opportunity to make a change. And, decided it was kind of a wild decision, but some friends of mine had started a retail off-road shop here back in Wichita Falls and were doing well with it that I went to high school with. And they offered me the opportunity to come back and work with them, kind of get closer to home, shop space. I'd kind of honed my fab skills working with all these guys, was a decent fabricator, and decided I was going to sell my rock racer and sold it to a guy in Albuquerque, and then bought all these parts and decided I was going to build a 7200 desert race truck, which back then was a brand new class they had just introduced, which was in essence supposed to be a trophy truck, but with a V6. And I remember at the time, honestly, people were laughing at me when I told them I was going to build one. Like, you got, there's no way you could do that. You could build something, you know, yourself. And honestly, looking back, I mean, they were kind of right. We had no idea what we were doing, but we did get the thing built, and it took about a year and a half, and that's I mean, I worked on this thing like 20 hours a day, 7 days a week. All I did was work on building this truck. And, you know, that kind of started the next, you know, chapter of my life slash career, whatever you want to call it. I kind of switched from the rock sports to the desert at that time, probably my mid-20s, and worked, got it done, and found some local sponsors. I joked, I was kind of like Tin Cup, the golf movie, showing up to my first desert race. We get out there, and all these other guys got energy drinks and shock companies and Ford and all this on their car. And I think we had a septic company and a farm implement supply company.
Is that why you called
it the
tractor?
A couple of my other buddies helped me get out there, and it was the 07 Henderson 250 was our first event. And we showed up. We had no GPS. The other racers, they couldn't believe it. Like, you guys don't have a GPS? And I was like, no way, man. That's like $1,500. We can't afford that. We're just going to go off the map. And they're just looking at me like I'm crazy. And we legitimately, Rich, my mom, I think, laminated the map, like with lamination. And our plan was literally to drive around and like look at laminated paper and just follow the markers, which in modern desert racing, if you're wondering, is not a good plan. It ended up raining and water got all in between the lamination. And so our maps got wet and everybody started running all the course markers. So we were basically just completely driving blind, had no idea kind of where we were at. Ended up rolling the truck pretty hard on the first lap, and kind of like my desert racing story. Almost anybody else probably would have quit. I don't know if I'm dumb or tough or maybe both. I don't know. But again, after crashing my car and destroying everything, I kind of left there, you know, like, this is it. This is the ultimate challenge. I want to win races, finish races, and do this with something I built. And, you know, you'd always heard people say trophy truck, and then it was 7,200, but my goal, I kind of set it. And I remember telling Nate on the phone, and he was like, dude, you're out of your mind. You got to own a casino to do that. And I was like, I'm going to race a trophy truck. You wait and see. I said, it may be a home built one. It may be a piece of junk, but like, I'm going to do it. And just kind of put my mind to it, and went back home and just kept working hard, and really didn't kind of stayed that course for a couple of years. And then kind of our first break, there was a show, it was called Danny and the Dingo on Fuel, a pretty big Fuel TV at the time, reality TV show. And my buddy, who we joke, he called himself my agent at the time. He was like, dude, I'm just going to try. If I can find anything for you, I'd like to help. And he actually sent the TV show an email, and they responded and decided they were going to come film this TV show, which was, you know, a national TV show. The whole hour was going to be on us. Danny Cass, Olympic snowboarder, was going to ride in the truck with me. And it was wild. Like, all of a sudden, we had sent maybe 250 sponsor emails for desert racing and couldn't get anybody to even return anything other than generic response. And then all of a sudden, the second that we had the official email that we were going to do the Danny and the Dingo show, it kind of broke the floodgates for us. We ended up getting a tire deal, a shock deal. You know, several companies wanted to come on board. Of course, you know, I'm realistic. It wasn't so much to be a part of my program as it was to get their stuff on TV. But regardless, it was kind of a start. It was like, you know, everybody always asks kind of what was your break. That was kind of the first one to even make it possible to keep going. And then that enabled us to run one more year. And I just fizzled out. The V6s started getting really expensive, almost trophy truck money level, and was kind of getting priced out and frustrated. And I remember making the joke. I said, dude, I built a full trophy truck. It just had a six cylinder. I said, dude, at this point, let's just put a 6.0 Chevrolet V8, like a 500 horse motor, an inner trophy truck. And everybody, like my crew and my friends, they're all laughing like, yeah, right. No, it kind of was a joke. So we're driving home, and I remember I looked down and the Mint 400 was going to come back. The Martellis had just got it, and it was 2012, and it was going to be the Mint 400. And like, you know, I just was like, man, Vegas Mint 400, like, holy, this is going to be so cool. Like, we should just put a V8 and go enter the Mint 400 and trophy truck. And like, then like the reality of like, I mean, how much is a junkyard 6.0? And literally, like, we like had a board and stroke junkyard 6.0, decided to throw it in there and go race the Mint 400 and trophy truck. And of course, they have qualifying, which I had never done before. coming from Rock Sports and 7200. And I'll never forget it. I'm in this home built piece of junk truck with a 6.0 motor, no dry sump, carburetor on a 6.0, would barely run, and it's random staging. And I had to, in qualifying, they put me behind Robbie Gordon and in front of Rob McCracken in my truck.
No pressure.
It's the MIT 400, and there's like 10,000 people, of course, out here watching or whatever. And I'm just like, I can tell you I've never been that nervous in my life, that's for sure. And amazingly, we got around there. It wasn't like, my friend said it wasn't embarrassing slow. Maybe they were being nice. The thing was loud. At least we had it like on straight headers, so it kind of at least sounded like a race motor, you know. And we went off. I mean, back then, I mean, it was probably 50 trucks at the first MIT. And I think we went off maybe like 30 or 35th. And I mean, my whole family came out. And like, I mean, it was such a big deal to me. And of course, the motor blew up first lap somewhere relatively quickly. Thing oil got hot, it blew up, not enough oiling, but still, like, I can see how much fun everybody had. I had a few sponsors that had come up to me and shook my hand that were like, man, this is a really cool story. Some kids in a home-built truck came out here and tried to race against, you know, the big dogs. And I mean, the thing, we was literally spray painted OD green, I mean, ugliest truck you've ever seen. And so we come home, but again, in our mind, you know, like, all we were away was we just needed a real motor is what we thought, and a little more seat time. And so we're back home, and I'm testing on a ranch out here, and I'll never forget it. It's the biggest break I've ever had in my life. It was a high fence game ranch, the God is Awesome Ranch, Texana Ranch, where there's still races to today. They let me come test on their ranch. So we're driving around, and next door, the people around the ranch next door, I look over and they're in a Raptor kind of watching us. I'm like, oh, they got a Raptor. That's pretty cool. And so sure enough, they come over, and turns out, Jeff, who I'll get to in a second, Jeff Miller and his son, Max, is who rolls up. They're owners of Trophy Tractor. We had done a little work on his son's truck in the past at my buddy's retail shop. So we kind of knew him, small world type of deal. And so, Jeff asked if I'd give the two of them a ride. And of course, you know, anybody that wanted to ride, especially back then, I'm like, come on. So gave her both a ride, could see they were really enjoying it. And Jeff asked me, while I was getting them his ride, why I didn't have a big company on the door. And, I said, man, I'm trying to find one. And that's what's holding me back. I'll be honest. Like, we just raced the MIT. We're out of money. I'm just testing until we're just looking for a break. And he said, well, maybe I'd like to get my logo on the side of that. And I said, oh, you got a business, sir? And he said, yeah, I've got a heavy equipment sales and rental company. And, you know, very modest guy, kind of downplayed it and told me that he'd be interested in me coming by his office the following Monday and talking about being a sponsor on the car. And so we go home and kind of Google his business, and you could see, like I said, he's a modest guy. He had a, and he still does, has a heck of an operation here selling mining equipment, you know, all over the world. And, you know, I could tell that maybe, you know, he wasn't popping off, that this guy realistically, you know, could be a good fit for our team. And so I went and had a meeting with him on that Monday, and I'll never forget it. Like, I didn't think I had a chance. I brought all this paper in there, a budget, you know, trying to be as professional as I could. But never really been in any type of meeting like that, especially talking about the type of money it takes to run a trophy truck program. And at the end of it, he stood up and shook my hand and said, let's do it. And I was like, he's still in shock. Like, let's do what? And he said, let's run this truck. Like, I'll commit. Let's do one race. I'll be your primary sponsor. And if it goes well, you know, we'll just kind of go from there. And so our first race was Vegas to Reno, and I'll never forget. I'd got product and I'd won some prize money, but I'd never really got like real funding, a real sponsor check. And I'll never forget one. And that day he sent me with the check. And I remember just looking at that thing. Like, I don't even think I cashed it for like 2 weeks. I just held it and looked at it, just in shock that somebody had enough faith in us that they would help us do something like this. And so our first race under the Trophy Tractor team name was Vegas to Reno. And prior to his help, I don't think we'd ever gone 100 miles in a desert race. We always had problems, and we went, the race is like roughly 540. We went 525 miles. He was like longer than we've ever gone. And we lost the engine with 15 miles to go from finishing our first best in the desert race. And I was sick. I'll be honest. I remember unplugging the radio crying. Cause in my mind, I figured if I finished the race, he might help me again. But now I just didn't finish the race. I blew this motor we just bought up. Like, there was your one shot. You were so close and you blew it. And just really, really bummed. I mean, we were even trying, like, it had a hole in the block, and I was trying to undo the connecting rod and try to drive it out of there on seven cylinders. And it wasn't going to happen. So I had to radio Jeff and let him know we weren't going to get the truck. And I know how excited he was to see his logo and everything on that podium, and we didn't make it happen. And so we all kind of part ways that night. And then the next morning at breakfast, I'll never forget it. It was pretty early. We were all going to have to, he was going to fly back home to Texas. And he was like, well, when's the next one? And I couldn't believe he even asked it. And I said, it's in October. You know, there's only 6 weeks between these events, Jeff. And he said, well, we better get us another motor order today then, huh? And I was like, really? And he said, yeah. That killed me too. I saw how close you were. He's like, I got the bug now too. Let's do this deal. And so we finished up that year. He kind of got me to the end. And I think honestly that maybe he might've just done that one year, and I'll never forget it. The Tesco guys kind of ribbed us a little bit, you know, kind of just poking fun at us. And, that last race when we were loading up, and Jeff's a competitive guy, and I could tell it kind of packed him off a little bit. And I remember he came up to me and hit me on the shoulder, and he said, hey, we're running again next year. And I said, we are. And he said, yeah, we're going to beat Tesco too. I said, huh? He said, yeah, we're going to beat Tesco. You watch. That's my goal. He said, let's get it done. And so he was a man of his word, and, you know, kind of turning into a little bit of a ramble on it. But I mean, in the end, fast forward, that was 2012. And I'm still racing with Trophy Tractor today. Been an 11-year relationship. We did over 50 trophy truck events together. We later changed to 6100 and now Class 1. But there's not a lot of guys that can say they raced 50 events, stood the test of the time. You see a lot of guys maybe get to race a trophy truck one or two times and kind of fade. But you know, we were there at dang near a solid 10 years, you know, at it, and really proud of that. And
you still have that relationship. That's awesome.
Yeah, still have that relationship. And then we went from trucks I built myself to, again, purely with Jeff and Trophy Tractor and my great product sponsors. BFG's been with me almost since the beginning. We were able to get our Armada fully professionally built trophy truck with all the good parts in it. And at the end there, we had a good two season run in what I consider a competitive truck, a really competitive truck. You know, we had a third place finish in one of the 2 day events in a trophy truck. We never, looking back, I never won a big event in trophy truck, but I mean, I don't know as a privateer how realistic that goal really is. But you know, we had a number of top 10 finishes, and that next year we finished fifth in points out of 60 trucks and best in the desert, and actually beat both Tesco trucks. So
nice.
Jeff was really proud of that. And that was finishing top five for the year when everyone was running one series. I mean, that was back when all the guys were, if you raced in the US, you were running best in the desert. There really wasn't any other place to run. So to finish with all the heavy hitters, you know, was really the highlight of my trophy truck career.
Awesome. And now, and then you went, is that, after the trophy truck, you said you went to,
what happened was as everybody sees now, the trophy trucks kind of were going the all wheel drive direction. Everyone was going big block. And, I mean, I a lot of people, I think, would guess a number that takes to run a truck even somewhat competitively, but once you factor in all wheel drive, big blocks, the new generation, what trophy truck is now, I mean, we were already on a shoestring budget at a big disadvantage when everybody was with small blocks and two wheel drive. And in essence, Jeff and I had a meeting. We were either going to have to build another new trophy truck to have anything remotely competitive, or we have the option of converting our existing truck to 6100 and determine that that was better use of the funds. And at the end of the day, we're both competitive, and we got to believe, you know, that we got a shot to get on the podium and win races. And when the four wheel drives came up, that just really wasn't going to happen in our current truck. So we moved to 6100. And about that time, that's kind of when I we ran a couple events, and then through social media, I actually started running a little bit with RJ Anderson, and that kind of formed that partnership. I was getting a little older as far as desert racing is concerned. I used to do all the driving, but then, you know, in your late 30s, trying to just solo Vegas, Torino, and some of these 500 plus mile events in a 6100 truck, 10, 12, 14 hours in there, you know, kind of started to realize it probably be more on pace, be better to have two fresh guys, which most of our competitors were doing. And, you know, wanted to bring somebody that was really talented that could help us. Social media was starting getting obviously big at that point, and realized that that was the direction marketing and everything else was going. So I was like, man, I need to find a teammate that's savvy with video promotion, you know, the business side of the sport. And RJ and his family are fantastic at that. And we kind of tried it on at one event, and now we've been, I think this is our fourth year. We've run every race together since the first one now. And so that's kind of been a good partnership. All of our sponsors kind of align, as far as BF Goodrich, Rigid, Walker Evans Wheels. So it was kind of a natural fit for both of us.
Excellent. And I take it that the future holds the same as for right now. Do you have any plans on jumping back into the TTs?
I do. I've kind of, like a lot of people, life has changed for me quite a bit, you know, over the last, you know, 5 years. I've got two boys married, 8 and 6, and all the time away from home, of course, being based out of Texas and trying to run a full championship season, a trophy truck between Tessin and everything is, you know, probably half the year away from the house. You got to figure if you want to be competitive, and really that isn't viable anymore with my home life. So we've kind of migrated to, we run 3 or 4 big events now, and that kind of necessitated the move to class one, running a truck only 3 or 4 times to have all the equipment, everything that it takes to run a truck, all the extra bodies, et cetera. You know, kind of the juice really wasn't worth the squeeze. And so kind of my new plan now is I've stepped back. I call it, you know, jokingly semi-retired running. Last year we ran King of the Hammers Mint Baja 500 in a local Texas event. I think we'll probably do the same this year. Maybe the 1000, just kind of trying to focus on some big events, you know, make sure we're still relevant in the sport, still getting out there. But kind of the master plan is I'm really focusing on business these days more than racing, trying to build my fabrication shop into something where maybe, you know, 5 to 10 year outlook, I'd sure like to build my own all wheel drive truck out of this shop and race it with my two boys. You know, I can't think of, that'd be the icing on the cake, so to speak, to dedicate. And I mean, for lack of a better way to say it, this is all I've ever done since 17. So I can't think of a cooler way to wind down is to race it with them and then eventually pass it over to those guys and just crew chief for them and watch them have all the fun and memories that I've got to have in this sport.
Cool. And your business is at the Area 53?
Yeah, that's our fabrication business. And we've been, like I said, I kind of had all these tools you got to have just to keep a truck running. And then kind of when COVID hit, of course, I'm sure for everybody, that's how I made my living, was off racing. I mean, that's all I do. And when COVID came, of course, sponsorship became tough for everyone, especially financial help. And so just honestly, for lack of a better way to say it, just to survive, keep the shop, keep the employees, keep the guys paid, we started having to take on outside work, working and prepping on other people's cars, doing race car builds, rock crawler stuff. And it kind of, you know, was a blessing in disguise. Like, it was the hardest time as far as racing, but like, I never really knew like how much work, I guess, was out there, so to speak, for the shop. And then, you know, we kind of got some good equipment in here, CNC stuff, and then have got into industrial and aerospace manufacturing. I'd say we're 60% manufacturing business, 40% motorsports these days. And, you know, we've got five guys here plus me. So, you know, we've kind of morphed on accident from a race team to a manufacturing facility. And, you know, but now I kind of see the light. You know, you never could tell I have young guys hit me up all the time, 18, 19, 20, how do I race a trophy truck? And I remember people telling me this, they didn't want you want to hear, but the honest truth is, the easiest way is go focus on building a business, make some money, then race a trophy truck in your 30s. Don't try to do it when you're 20 is the honest truth. And it took me 20 years to finally see. I don't know. I would have changed the way I did it. I mean, the memories were priceless, but I definitely did it the harder way. Spending other people's money is much harder than making your own. I promise you that.
That's true. That is so true. So
it really is.
Talk about the family.
So got my oldest boy, he's 8, is Drake, and then Wyatt 6, and they want to do everything like dad. The shop's here behind the house, so both of them are in there. We've got a dirt bike track behind the back, and we've been helping RJ we took the whole family up to Crandon, kind of spent a decent amount of time out there in the summer, and I've been trying to keep him away from the trophy carts I can, but over there, and now he's discovered that you can race at 8 years old, and got the never-ending questions of when is it my turn. And so if I had to guess, we'll probably be putting together some kid racers in the shop here pretty quick.
Awesome. Well, that's good. It's good that you're in a position where you can think about doing that.
Yeah, and you know, and it's funny how life works. You know, 5 or for sure 10 years ago, coming down, and you hear people say that, they say, "Oh, it's, you know, I'm going to focus on my kids. I get more enjoyment out of it." And you think, "Oh, that's just some crazy old man. He's just saying that. There's no way." But I mean, I think anybody tell you this, so true. To watch your kid do something is 100 times better than doing it yourself. And so I can't even imagine when they cross the line at their first race or get their first win, feeling that must be. And I think that's why, you know, if you look at any off-road sport, rock crawling, desert racing, I mean, they're all so family oriented, family driven. I mean, I think almost every guy desert racing, you know, his dad is more than likely right there, probably did it before him. And, you know, I think that's why you see so many multi-generational families in off-road racing and motorsport. Once you get a taste of it, they're in the real world that compares, you know?
Right. Well, Adam, I want to say thank you so much for spending the time and conversing.
Absolutely.
And talking about your life and everything. And I really, truly wish you the best of luck in the future.
We haven't talked, Rich,
in years. And when I saw your name pop up again at KOH this year, I was like, all right, you were already on the list. There's certain people that guys have asked, you know, hey, what, you know, find out what this guy's doing, you know, get him on the podcast. And you were one of those. So
yeah,
it was
awesome.
Thank you for taking the time and making this work.
Absolutely. And I really appreciate the opportunity you've given me to be on here today. And it was great talking and catching up.
All right. You take care and enjoy life, buddy.
You do the same.
Okay.
Let's not let it go a couple years this and that.
Absolutely.
All right. Later, buddy.
Okay. Take care. Bye. Well, that's another episode of Conversations with Big Rich. I'd like to thank you all for listening. If you could do us a favor and leave us a review on any podcast service that you happen to be listening on, or send us an email or a text message or a Facebook message and let me know any ideas that you have, or if there's anybody that you have that you think would be a great guest, please forward the contact information to me so that we can try to get them on. And always remember, live life to the fullest. Enjoying life is a must. Follow your dreams and live life with all the gusto you can. Thank you.